Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Musk-Hawain. How did some of Donald Trump's biggest detractors ultimately become his greatest enablers? That is the question at the heart of a new book by Atlantic writer Mark Leibovich. Thank You for Your Servitude recently jumped to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. It gives readers a window into the Trump administration, not through the White House, but through the Trump International Hotel, where everyone who was anyone in Trump's orbit showed up at some point. The book traces how Trump created what the author calls a culture of submission and how his critics-turned-cheerleaders humored him all the way to January 6th and beyond. Mark Leibovich is a former New York Times chief national correspondent and is now a staff writer for The Atlantic. He's the author of four books, including the 2013 bestseller This Town, about the political culture of Washington, D.C. He joins us now to talk about his new book, Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission. Mark Leibovich, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Tracy. It's good to be here.
Well, Mark, there is so much to talk about in your book, but before we get to that, I would be remiss if I did not ask you about some of the recent developments that we've been watching this week in particular. Of course, on Monday, we learned that the FBI had executed a search warrant on Trump's residence in Mar-a-Lago, seemingly looking for some classified documents. I know you've been watching all of that along with the rest of us. What did you make of that?
Well, I mean, what I made of it is it's shocking. It's never happened before. I don't remember anything analogous to it. What's also clear is we just don't know a lot right now. There's been a lot of jumping of the gun and as far as making conclusions and fairly excitable responses, especially from a lot of Donald Trump supporters. But ultimately, I think this is the kind of thing that we're going to learn more about, and it's going to come into hopefully a more understandable context over the next few days and weeks. But I also think that the whole situation is really troubling and sad, just sort of seeing the real sort of immediate sort of going to one's corners. Again, Donald Trump's supporters very reflexively supporting him in the most, you know, in some cases, very violent possible terms. And to me that, you know, I'm not trying to bring this to the book a little, you know, totally, but it actually is very much in line with the culture of submission that Donald Trump created around him during his presidency through January 6th and really beyond to this day, to a point where we are still in this situation where the entire Republican Party is in lockstep with the personal interests and personal victimization of the president himself.
Well, in line with that, Mark, I want to read you something that your colleague David Frum wrote yesterday in The Atlantic, and the article was called Trump's Ultimate Loyalty Test. And here's the quote. He says, the former president has discovered a new test of power, using his own misconduct to compel party leaders to rally to him. One by one, they have executed the ritual of submission. Kevin McCarthy, Marco Rubio, even the would-be Trump replacer Ron DeSantis. He says maybe they're inwardly hoping the FBI will do for them what they are too weak and frightened to do for themselves, but outwardly, they are all indignation and threats of retribution. That's the end of the quote. And of course, even we saw Mike Pence with a tweet expressing deep concern about the search. Mike Pence, the one who Trump supposedly said deserved to be hanged. And so it does very much go to the point of your book about regardless of what Trump does, his support remains solid.
Yeah, I mean, what David said is 100% correct. And it's also very much in line with the recent history of this. I mean, you could sort of say that the reaction over the last 36 hours to this, investigation of Trump's Mar-a-Lago, you know, compound, I wouldn't call it a raid. It sounds much more orderly than that. But I think what we've seen from Republicans is very much in line with what we saw from them in the weeks after January 6th. There was maybe some initial shock followed by just everyone kind of falling in line. And again, what David said, and this is again a major theme of the book, is that they might have been secretly hoping that the FBI just brings him down, or in the case of January 6th, that, you know, that he's impeached or that he is rendered completely, unviable going forward. But ultimately, you know, in public, they're going to support him because that has sort of been what the cowardly dynamic of their own inner selves and also of the broader party objective has become. And that's unfortunately where we are today. And I think right now we have a very dangerous situation that's only going to become more so.
Well, speaking of that, and you alluded to the anger moments ago, there certainly has been a lot of angry rhetoric that's been coming, particularly from the far right. The New York Times reported that the New York Young Republicans said that the search amounted to crossing the Rubicon. Someone else said this was the hill to die on. Some others have raised once again that prospect of civil war that we keep hearing about. What do you think that the fallout will be from Trump's based on this? Do you anticipate seeing more violence as a result of what's happened?
I mean, I certainly hope not. I don't think any of us certainly want to see that. But I mean, how can you not be concerned about it, given what the rhetoric says? And look, it doesn't take much to set someone off. And we've seen this again and again and again. And I think a lot of us are somewhat surprised that it hasn't happened on a larger scale to this point, but it already has happened on a very large and shocking scale. I mean, beginning with January 6th, but there have been other instances too. So, look, I mean, if this were a normal world, if this were a normal formal president, if this were a normal party, and I lay this out in the book quite a bit, I mean, within 48 hours of November 3rd, when it was clear that Joe Biden was going to win this, this House Majority Leader, or the, you know, Kevin McCarthy, Mitch McConnell, Mike Pence, you know, basically the grown-up apparatus, such as it is, of the Republican Party would have congratulated the new president. Donald Trump would have not quickly, but he would have been eventually marginalized. Eventually, it would have been a lot easier just to sort of send him away into the memory that I think a lot of these Republicans will privately say they want him to be in. But unfortunately, this path to humoring, this ongoing humoring, which in a sense is in the same context, is what leads not only to January 6th, but also to the complete divisions we have in the party. I mean, Joe Biden was inaugurated in front of a city that had 25,000 National Guard troops patrolling it, largely from the former president's supporters. I mean, that's not a very good look for democracy. And unfortunately, despite the attempts to sort of reinforced normalcy in the U.S. government over the last couple of years, we are still at a very dangerous point today when, you know, FBI agents and the U.S. Justice Department, you know, trying to enforce the law, wind up in a situation like this, where immediately within a couple of days of something like this happening, you have talk of civil war, which, again, very, very disconcerting. And hopefully it doesn't come to anything beyond just words.
You said, Mark, in an earlier conversation that you do expect that Trump would take a third run at the presidency. Do you think that this search could potentially change the calculus of that, given that we're now, you know, 90-ish days from midterms? There was talk about him making an early announcement. Does this change the calculus at all, in your view?
You know, in a lot of the early coverage, a lot of the early speculation says that this will help him, this will bolster him, this would make him more likely to announce an earlier run. I think, you know, in the short-term political calculation, Democrats would be thrilled to make Donald Trump the issue versus the problems that the Democrats and President Biden have with inflation and gas prices and whatnot. But I think it's, again, too soon to tell. But I do think, look, it does certainly give you a sense of how Donald Trump can effectively snap his fingers and the party's infrastructure will just sort of come running to his defense, which I think is the same dynamic, which will probably make him a extremely, extremely decisive front runner if he decides to run again, which I think he clearly will.
Yeah. Well, and now to the book. And let me take a moment to invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or call us at 888-477-9499. We're talking with Mark Leibovich about his new book, Thank You for Your Servitude, about the Trump presidency. And Mark, one of the big themes, of course, that runs through your book is the joke that everybody was in D.C. What was the joke during the Trump presidency?
Well, the joke has always been sort of an established Washington notion, which is, you know, we're all in on the joke, meaning this is something we all know to be true intuitively, but we cannot speak it publicly because that would be wrong. I mean, 10 years ago when I wrote This Town, which is my first book about Washington, the joke was essentially, okay, I might be a Democrat, you might be a Republican, but ultimately we are going to start a lobbying business together, even though we're in the Senate now or in Congress now, and we're going to make a lot of money because there's no such thing in Washington as the Republicans or the Democrats. There's only the Green Party, green as in money. Right now, the joke over the last few years, the joke in American politics inside the Republican Party has been that privately, Republicans, think that Trump is a dangerous moron, basically. The same people who praise him to the nines on TV, the Kevin McCarthy's, the Lindsey Graham's, the Marco Rubio's, you know, many of whom said this explicitly when they were running against him or less certain that he was going to be the president, will now, you know, they're basically very two-faced about it. And that is like the dirty little secret, which is a terrible secret at this point, about how they really feel about him. Unfortunately, they've succeeded in just neutering themselves to a point where they have none of the agency. And what I tried to do in Thank You for Your Servitude is just essentially tell the story of how this culture grew up and the kind of, you know, insane and in some places quite darkly humorous ways that they try to make these accommodations. And unfortunately, that is the sad reality of what the joke has become in Washington, D.C., especially during the Donald Trump era.
Will you spotlight certain individuals, some of whom you have already named, as a way to tell that story of how that evolution took place? You talk about the genuflectors, sycophants, suck-ups, and brown nosers, just to name a few, who trashed Trump in 2016 before becoming outspoken defenders. And you devote a lot of time to Lindsey Graham, who told you point blank why he fell in line.
I mean, Lindsey Graham basically said, you know, he said on the record repeatedly that he has no regard for this guy through 2016 and even beyond into his presidency, into Trump's presidency. But, you know, when I asked him, you know, how could you do this? He basically said, look, if you're in politics, you want to be relevant. And I want to be relevant by, one, being a senator from South Carolina, where Trump is very, very possible. So I need to fall into line. I can't be as relevant as I want to be if I'm not a U.S. senator. So basically, and this is a direct quote from Lindsey Graham, if you don't want to be reelected, you're in the wrong business. Relevance for Lindsey Graham also means being on the golf course with Donald Trump, being able to say, yeah, I was just on the phone with the president today. Basically being in the frame, being in the mix. And Lindsey Graham said, look, it's like being at the dice table. I get a real rush to do this. It becomes addictive after a while. And, you know, for the price of submission in that case, the price of like him getting that sort of rush is to do the bidding of Donald Trump, who he intuitively, I think in private, will say that, you know, isn't at worst a criminally dangerous president. But ultimately in public, if he gives Lindsey Graham the rush, he will be there for him and he will be one of his top supporters and continue to talk to him on a regular basis.
Mark, I've got 30 seconds before I have to take a break, but Kevin McCarthy is another one that you devote some ink to. And for him, it's all about the next step in his career.
Yeah, I talked to Kevin McCarthy a lot in my book. I mean, he wants to be Speaker of the House. He can't be Speaker of the House without Donald Trump's blessing. And he also just loves the celebrity aspects of it. I spent, you know, a long time with him in California and elsewhere, just watching him flash through his phone with pictures of himself with famous politicians, Democrats, Republicans, celebrities, and so forth. So it's a similar rush with Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah. We have to take a break right here. We are talking about Mark Leibovich's new book, Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission. Your questions and comments and much more to come when Radio Times comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with Mark Leibovich about his new book, Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission. Mark's name is no doubt familiar to many of our listeners. He has been the New York Times chief national correspondent for a number of years. He is now a staff writer for The Atlantic. He's the author of a number of books, including This Town in 2013, which was another bestseller, about the political culture of Washington, D.C. Let me invite our listeners to join us in the conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes, or call us at 888-477-9499. Mark, before we continue with the book, I want to read you this email from Bill. who says, as important and revealing as Mr. Leibovich's book and the many books on the Trump presidency have been, the last 48 hours have shown us how entrenched many are in his personality cult. I know only one Republican who has switched parties because of Trump, and she did it during his 2016 candidacy. I'd like you to just comment on that cult of personality idea.
Well, I think it's 100% true. And obviously, you know, this is a term that's been thrown around. I mean, Liz Cheney's been using it a lot lately. She is one of the probably the highest profile sort of in-house, you know, rebel as far as, you know, fighting against the Trump spell on the Republican Party. But yeah, I think that that's 100% true. I will say that I have known a number of Republicans who are no longer Republicans or who are Republicans, but are certainly not Trump Republicans. I don't know if explicitly they have said, okay, I'm now a Democrat, I'm now an independent, I'm renouncing my Republican registration. But ultimately, there is a lot. I've known a lot of Republicans who are quite ambivalent, if not, you know, completely want nothing to do with a party that has given over to Donald Trump as it is now. So again, I mean, that has shown to be somewhat definitive in favor of Democrats. It certainly was in 2018, and it certainly was for Joe Biden. But ultimately, yeah, I mean, the Republicans remain one of our two major parties. Donald Trump came pretty close the last time. And look, if you look at how the states and the polling and the historical trends go, I mean, it looks like Republicans, you know, have a pretty good shot of certainly taking the House in November and possibly the Senate, too. And again, these are going to be very Trumpy Republicans, much more so than there were 4 years ago, 2 years ago. So I think his spell on the party is only getting stronger.
Well, you mentioned some of the Republicans who have not bowed the knee, if you will, to Trump, and you certainly devote some time to them in your book as well. You talk about Mitt Romney. You talk about John McCain. Of course, you mentioned Liz Cheney. You also talk about Paul Ryan, who resigned as Speaker of the House early in 2019. And I want to zero in on a conversation that you had with him about January 6th and how he reacted as he watched all of that play out from home.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Ryan, I mean, look, a lot of these conversations I had in reporting the book, they kind of took on the flavor of therapy sessions in some way. And Paul Ryan was talking about, you know, he left the Speaker's office a couple of years earlier. Republicans lost their majority. He didn't run for re-election in 2018. He was sitting in his office. He's now doing a whole bunch of things. He's on the Fox News board and so forth. And he was talking about sitting in his office, watching the events of January 6th and seeing what was happening and recognizing a lot of his old security details and the Capitol Hill police that he used to see every day, you know, just being deluged by this furious mob who were supporting the president. And, you know, we know what they were trying to do. Paul Ryan talked about bursting into tears. He's not a crier, but suddenly he was just overcome with emotion about what had become of our political situation. And I think, you know, his party, too. Finally, I asked him, I said, Mr. Speaker, I mean, were any of these cries or tears of guilt at all or of complicity? I mean, you worked pretty closely with Donald Trump for a while there. You helped him get his signature tax bill passed. And, you know, to this day, you're still sitting on the board of Fox News. I mean, what about that? You know, Paul Ryan wasn't going there, but he also was obviously very conflicted about this whole thing. So, look, again, there were a lot of conversations like this and sort of putting together the narrative of these last few years. And, you know, a lot of these conversations were pretty emotional at times. You know, other times they were lighter, but ultimately these are serious times and you know, very human stories at the center of them.
And you write at some length about John McCain, of course, who famously gave the thumbs down to the vote on killing Obamacare. And I guess the question, Mark, is the John McCain variety of Republican all but gone these days?
You know, it sort of depends on the state, but I think largely that's true. I mean, a lot of like the John McCain Republicans aren't exactly, you know, announcing themselves as such, and they aren't doing terribly well in these Republican primaries. I mean, again, the results from some of these primaries over the last few months has been that it has become a party much more fused to the ideals of Donald Trump, and so much as he even has ideals, but, you know, the blunt force, the cult of personality, whatever you want to call it. But I mean, that to me is the central tenet of it. And unfortunately, people like, you know, John McCain or, you know, Liz Cheney, who stands a pretty good chance of losing her reelection, in a Republican primary in Wyoming next week. Any number of people probably won't be around much longer. And John McCain, unfortunately, is no longer with us. But I also think that his whole ilk of Republicanism is to, in large degree, a dying breed. And it's a sad situation. But again, this is the story of the Republican Party now. And in so much as it's one of the major parties in the country, it is the story of America.
And to that point, you, in the course of preparing for this book, asked a number of people in Trump's orbit about the idea of legacy and how they might be remembered for their role in enabling Trump. And the responses that you got were eye-opening. Can you share some of what people told you?
Yeah, it was basically, I mean, they would look at me like I had two heads. I mean, Kevin McCarthy said, oh, yeah, legacy. Yeah, I don't really care about that. I mean, Rudy Giuliani said repeatedly, yeah, I don't really think about that. I'll be dead. Trump himself said right after the election, he said to Hope Hicks, one of his top aides at that point, he said, look, if I lose this election, that'll be my legacy. William Barr, Lindsey Graham, I mean, a number of people who are recurring characters in the book said similar things. Ultimately, their belief, or at least their defense, or whatever their view is that, look, the short-term expediencies of winning their next election and pleasing Donald Trump and sort of taking care of his feelings and making sure that he's okay is far more important than any historical verdict that the sort of abstract, quote, future historians render upon their stewardship in Washington. I thought it was quite sad. Frankly, it gave me a very, very cynical viewpoint of what their own cynicism looked like and the effect it could have on the country and how it's being run.
And yet it seemed like those politicians who come from political families, from dynasties, if you will, seem to have a different view and maybe place a higher value on that idea of legacy.
Yeah, this came up a lot in a lot of the interviews I did. I mean, essentially, people who come from political families, people like Liz Cheney, people like, you know, John McCain wasn't a political family necessarily, but it was a military family. Mitt Romney, whose father was a somewhat mavericky governor, three-term governor of Michigan, a Republican. Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland, his father was a strange sort of, Republican congressman who voted against Watergate. And there were a number of political sort of heirs or scions, whatever you want to call them, who seemed to have a much larger sense of their political duty. There were also people who played, you know, who had military service. Again, McCain, Adam Kinzinger, fought in Afghanistan. I mean, there were people like, who also had people who were at the Pentagon at the time, like Mark Milley, now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, also people of faith. I mean, Senator Romney is certainly in that category. Jeff Flake, who was a former senator from Arizona, they're both from the Latter-day Saints Church, and they both, had a sense of duty. I mean, this has been coming up again in a lot of the witnesses before the January 6th committee. I mean, that does seem to be sort of a recurring theme in a lot of the people who are willing to sort of act independently outside of that spell that Donald Trump has on the party.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and our guest is Mark Leibovich. We're talking about his new book, Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission. Mark, there's a question here from Ronald who says, and this harkens back to our earlier question about the joke, is Donald Trump in on the joke, he asks, and does Donald Trump understand the joke?
That's a really great question. I mean, I think, you hear that a lot. I mean, Lindsey Graham used to tell me, or he told me a couple times, he said, Donald Trump is in on the joke. He knows what he's doing here. I mean, in a way, it's even more depressing how cynical he is. I do believe that Donald Trump ultimately doesn't have a whole lot of regard for a lot of his supporters, which is sort of sad. But yeah, Donald Trump, I mean, he's a showman. He is he lies a lot. He all he cares about is himself. I mean, we have seen this over and over and over again. But yeah, I think he knows exactly what he's doing. I mean, I think there was another author, it might have been Michael Wolff, who asked him, Mr. Trump, do you understand, like, you're in on the act, right? How much of this is an act? And he said, oh, it's totally in on the act. And I also think, I remember in his memoir, William Barr, the attorney general, said Trump used to sort of say, you can only put too much crazy in your tweets. And also, I spent enough time with Trump during certainly the first campaign, and I had a visit with him earlier in his presidency, where he always knew where the lines were. He would very very frequently toggle between on and off the record. He knew what he could say that went right up to the line and what didn't. So, yeah, my sense is that he got the joke as well as anyone, which in a sense is even scarier about the whole thing.
You write that the book is about the view from the Trump Hotel in D.C., the flagship Paola Palace, as you call it. Mark, why did you choose the hotel as sort of a ground zero to anchor the book?
Well, first of all, I wanted to differentiate, Thank You for Your Servitude, with a lot of the other Trump books, with a lot of the White House books, with a lot of the campaign books. I mean, those are generally the main genres of Trump books that we've seen in the last few years. I mean, I wanted to write about the larger sort of novelistic culture, the kind of bizarre, the sort of, the Rick's American Cafe, if you will, of Washington. And Donald Trump's hotel, the Trump International Hotel, was effectively the Republican capital of Washington for the Trump years. I mean, it is this beautiful hotel located right between the White House and the Capitol on Pennsylvania Avenue in the old post office building. And you would go there, and a lot of reporters went there, including me. I mean, pretty much any night of the week, and you would see administration officials. Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, lived there with his wife. Rudy had a place there. A lot of Republican congressmen would come in here, would go in there. A lot of, you know, it was just like, it was kind of like Cheers for the Trump world, right? And, you know, the piece de resistance would be these tourists coming in hoping to see the president himself, hoping to see Cinderella going to the palace. And Donald Trump would go in there periodically, too. It was like literally the steakhouse of the Trump Hotel was literally the one place he would go out for dinner outside of the White House in Washington. I mean, in contrast, the Obamas used to sort of sneak out for these little date nights at these sort of trendy bistros in Georgetown or someplace. Maybe they'd come in through the kitchen, they'd greet the staff. They didn't want to make a big fuss. Trump needed the big applauded entrance, and he'd go in and he'd have his supporters standing on the table, sort of chanting his name. And then he'd go to his, you know, his designated table at the steakhouse. He would order the same thing every time, a 40-ounce tomahawk.
Mark, I think we may have lost audio there. Let's see if we can get that back. We are talking with Mark Leibovich. He is the author of Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission. If Mark's name sounds familiar, it's because he was a writer for the New York Times for many years. He is now a staff writer for The Atlantic, and he has been joining us via Zoom to talk about this new book. The book is essentially about the people in Trump's orbit. Many of them were never Trumpers, going all the way back to 2015, 2016, when Trump was running for the presidency. And of course, over the course of time, so many of the people who had said that they would never support Donald Trump became some of his biggest enablers, some of his biggest cheerleaders. And as Mark writes in his book, he talks about how that enabling helped contribute to January 6th and beyond. So we have been talking with Mark about that. We've been talking about some of the more recent developments this week. Certainly the search by the FBI of Trump's residence in Mar-a-Lago. The fact that Donald Trump will be deposed today by the New York Attorney General. There are a number of investigations going on. And so there's been lots to talk about. I believe we may have Mark back now. Mark, are you there?
Hi, Tracy. Sorry.
All right. It's technology, right?
Technology. So where did I cut out? Because I was on this long, I thought very eloquent diatribe about what the scene at the Trump Hotel was like.
Well, it was indeed. And I think where we left off, people were standing on tables and cheering when Trump walked in.
Well, basically, he would walk in and he would go and he would order the same thing every single time. He would get a 40-ounce tomahawk steak. He would get French fries. He would get a shrimp cocktail, chocolate cake for dessert, and a full bucket of perfectly chilled Diet Coke. Because, you know, watch the waistline. Yes, presidential figure, very, very important. But ultimately, look, and then he would sort of linger, and then he would leave, and he'd need standing ovation, and it was quite a scene. And again, this was the pinnacle for these sort of Trump-supporting tourists who would come in from, like, Tennessee or Texas or whatever, hoping to get a glimpse of Hugh Hefner at the Playboy Mansion or Cinderella at the castle or whatever you want to call it. But it was always quite a scene. And so that was kind of a recurring motif and a recurring sort of venue for a lot of the reporting I did for this book.
And then in contrast to that, Mark, we fast forward to January 6th, and you write about how dark and despondent Trump was after the 2020 election and how, you know, the people around him chose to affirm the big lie that the election was stolen. And you summed it up with the phrase, what's the downside for humoring him? And as you write, of course, the answer to that question became abundantly clear come January 6th.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, no one wanted to stand up to him. I mean, what people forget is that Republicans needed to be the first line of defense here, adult Republicans, Republicans who care about the country. You know, Richard Nixon left the White House because ultimately Republicans, Barry Goldwater, a number of sort of elder statesman types, walked up to the White House and said, Mr. President, you are losing support. It is time to go. And Richard Nixon, you know, left because he lost the support of his party. Donald Trump lost the election. Every Republican on the Hill who was saying otherwise, who was shouting on TV, on Fox otherwise, knew that he lost the election. But they couldn't bring themselves to say, Mr. President, enough is enough. Congratulations to the president-elect. We are moving on. That is what normal Republicans would have done in a normal time under a normal president. Unfortunately, they went right along and refused to stand up to him to a point where not only did January 6th happen, but, you know, even almost more chillingly, the response after January 6th to what Donald Trump did that day, and which we're learning more and more about every month, you know, they just continued to humor him. And essentially humoring Donald Trump has now, for the sixth or seventh consecutive year, become essentially the platform of the Republican Party.
And the irony in all of this, Mark, and I have less than a minute to go here before we take another break, is that, you know, we saw these armed supporters, hordes of them, attempting to overthrow the government, prepared to give their lives for Donald Trump. And yet you quoted Howard Stern and his observation that the people who love Trump the most are the ones that he despises the most.
100%. I mean, look, I mean, Donald Trump could have pardoned any of them. I mean, he talks about, he pardoned a whole bunch of people, all of them, his donors, his friends, Jared's father-in-law, Steve Bannon, you know, go down the list. None of them were these sort of, you know, people who went and actually, you know, gave their lives or had their lives turned over for Donald Trump. So, yeah, ultimately he didn't. And as Howard Stern said, you know, none of them would ever be allowed inside Mar-a-Lago. So, yeah, he doesn't have a lot of he doesn't seem to have a lot of regard for the people who support him the most, beginning with Mike Pence, by the way.
Well, we'll talk more about that when we come back after a break. Our guest is Mark Leibovich, the author of Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission. More of your comments and questions when Radio Times comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wain, and we're talking with Mark Leibovich about his new book, Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission. Mark was formerly the New York Times chief national correspondent. He is now a staff writer for The Atlantic. We welcome your comments and questions. For Mark, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or call us at 888-477-9499. Mark, I have a number of comments here from our listeners that I would like to read to you. First one from Chris, who says hate via conservative media has become a drug for the GOP, so the more extreme is needed. I think this is why the John McCain GOP is all but gone. That's from Chris. Pat says, in the very early 1970s, as a young adult, I read a Time magazine article about Donald Trump. I surmised then that Trump was a greasy, oily, corrupt, and disgusting cheat. Today, as the numerous suits, including the fake real estate school, the use of his charity money for himself, and other such corrupt endeavors, I wonder how so many Americans continue to believe him. My criticism is that his supporters and the Republican Party are at fault for the corruption of our democracy, and they are traitors for allowing Trump to prevail in his criminality. On the flip side of that, Mark, there is one other comment here from Jim, who says he worries that the Democratic Party is also drifting away from its values. He says, I was so upset about the party funding extreme Republican candidates as a strategy, which he said he found infuriating. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that. Mark, are you there?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry about the technology problems here. I blame nature. Anyway, say that again real quick.
So we had a few comments here, and one of our listeners was expressing frustration with the Republican Party for enabling Trump, but another one worries that the Democratic Party is also drifting away from its values, particularly in funding extreme Republican candidates as a strategy.
You know, that's a great question. I mean, essentially, Republicans, you know, there are Trumpy candidates who are seem to be, you know, according to analyses, less likely to be Democrats in swing states. And what has happened is Democrats have actually tried to, you know, support them, given them money and raise money for them. And to me, that's a terrible look. And I think a lot of Republicans have been furious about it, thinking, okay, we're all basically fighting on the same team here. And yet at the end of the day, you're ultimately, you know, supporting very, very Trumpy candidates. I mean, we all have the same enemy. So why are you supporting our enemy? So, you know, ultimately, I think that that's been a very controversial tactic. I'm not sure it's worked, and I'm not sure it will pay off in November, but it certainly made a lot of potential allies very, very mad and has alienated a lot of the coalition.
Yeah. I want to talk about the January 6th hearings that have been playing out almost like a TV series through the summer, and more are promised in the fall. How effective do you think the hearings have been thus far?
I mean, I think much more so than I expected. I think that with the fact that all of the witnesses, or largely all the witnesses, have been Republicans, have been really, really compelling. I also think that, that the way that the hearings have been run, with sort of minimal speechifying from the panel, which is what you typically get in these kinds of things, has been really, really effective. The ratings have been really high. A lot of people have watched them. And if you sort of look at the margins, I mean, the poll numbers for Donald Trump have actually gone down a little bit. And look, I mean, I think just as big a story of that, and again, this is sort of my pet issue, but I think it's just as material, is that Republicans who are in a position of actual leadership have been totally silent about it. No one wants to talk about them. They're all claiming not to watch. They're all claiming it's a partisan witch hunt. So essentially, the substance and frankly, the pretty objective information that's sort of coming out of these hearings seems to be, you know, being met with a bunch of Republicans who are in position of leadership just plugging their ears. So that's dispiriting, but I also think it's the dynamic we're dealing with these days.
Early in the hearings, Mark, I'm sure you remember this, there was this sort of mic drop moment where Liz Cheney said of her Trump-supporting colleagues that, you know, one day Donald Trump will be gone, but your dishonor will remain.
Yeah.
But you also had to wonder if it isn't Trumpism, or what Adam Kinzinger has called learned Trumpism, that will remain. Can you talk about what learned Trumpism is and whether you think it's here to stay regardless of Trump himself?
I mean, man, I mean, that's right now, I think Trump is certainly here to stay for the near term. But yeah, I mean, whatever learned Trumpism is, it's the reflexive style of Donald Trump's politics. It's basically intimidation. It's you know, seemingly being perfectly comfortable with certainly illusions, if not explicit sanctification of violence, you know, flavors of potential racism, just no legitimacy for, you know, the other team having any kind of claim to power at all. And that's, you know, the essence of authoritarianism, and it's very, very scary. So you've seen a lot of Trump knockoffs around the country, people trying to imitate him, people trying to be like him, people trying to get elected like him. You know, it remains to be seen how effective it is. But ultimately, it's not like there's a big conservative ideology or sort of philosophical underpinning behind it, other than just retaining power and sort of bullying your opposition.
Well, to that point, I want to read you a couple more comments from our listeners. Fred says, Trump won in 2016 despite losing the popular vote by almost 3 million due to the Electoral College. He lost in 2020 by over 7 million in the popular vote. Since then, the Republican Party has sought to undermine democracy as they have thrown up numerous impediments to voting. Many dance around the fact that today's Republican Party is now the dictatorship party. And there's a tweet here from another listener who says, I'm reading a biography of Stalin. When admonished about his developing cult of personality, Stalin replied, what can I do? People need a god.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, normally, I mean, you know, I'm usually pretty quick to sort of say, okay, let's not get overheated here. But unfortunately, you hear these parallels, and I think that they're somewhat appropriate in these cases. I mean, hopefully it doesn't literally come to the point where, you know, we're living under a Stalinist regime. But ultimately, yeah, I mean, the echoes are pretty unmistakable. And when people say, well, you know, we're literally fighting for democracy or we're fighting against authoritarianism, I don't think that's overheated at all. I think that that's quite relevant to the conversations we're having these days. And hopefully it doesn't get, you know, beyond conversation to a point where we actually have political violence as a regular occurrence in this country. But no, I think that, like, look, we're getting dangerously close to the abyss, and I think this is a very serious story. But having said that, Tracy, it's a fun beach read.
No doubt about that.
I sort of stop myself. It's like, wow, that was really serious. People seem to be laughing at this book. It's entertaining. Okay, that has been said for the purposes of my book publicist.
Well, and as I like to say, Mark, it is it's a very funny book in a laugh to keep from crying kind of way.
That'll work for me.
But you know, you've also asked Republicans in the course of preparing for this book, some of whom have paid a heavy price for standing up to Trump, whether through death threats or doxing or whatever it might be. You've asked them if they would vote for him again. And it seems that even now, in spite of everything, many of them would not rule that out. In fact, you have a term for that. You call it calculated avoidance.
Yeah, I mean, it does take many forms. I mean, a lot of it's just literally senators running away from the question. I mean, literally, like, pretending to be on their cell phones. I mean, there's this recurring scene that you've seen on Capitol Hill, or I've seen on Capitol Hill, which is just like senators saying, sorry, I didn't see the tweet, or can't hear you, late for lunch. I mean, it's kind of a pathetic scene. But then even people like Brad Raffensperger, who was the Secretary of State of Georgia, who, you know, famously was on that call where Trump said, you know, you have to find me the enough votes to win. You know, he was asked this repeatedly on MSNBC, and he said, I won't rule it out. And you hear that over and over again. It's like, what? I mean, Liz Cheney and I guess Mitt Romney and a couple of others have kind of ruled out the idea of ever voting for him again. But ultimately, the numbers of people who have actually made that vow for whatever political calculations, you know, is pretty slim. So, yeah, I think that itself is a statement.
So I want to talk about 2024 a little bit. Who else besides Ron DeSantis do you see as a viable threat to Trump in 2024?
Yeah, I mean, my personal view is I don't think DeSantis is going to be much of a threat. I mean, I think, you know, he's obviously getting a lot of sort of attention now as a potential alternative. But I think Donald Trump has shown again and again that he can kind of, you know, just sort of stand at it. People will stand at attention when he decides that he wants something. Mike Pence is someone who seems to be making noises about running for president. I don't see that happening. And then, you know, there's actually people like Liz Cheney, Larry Hogan, governor of Maryland, who are pretty explicitly against Trump, who are making noises about running. I don't see a lot of support for that kind of mindset or that kind of candidate in this Republican Party. But, yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible that there could be a Republican race of some sort. But I think Trump is obviously the clear front runner. And I think if he wants the nomination, he'll get it.
So how about on the Democratic side? Do you see Biden running again? And should he run again?
Well, I mean, polls say overwhelmingly that Democrats don't want him to run again. He insists that he is. You know, his age is obviously, you know, it's the worst kept. He'll be 82 years old. I mean, when he starts his next term, or actually close to it, right? And he'd be 86 at the end of his second term. That's pretty old. But look, it's not like Democrats have anyone sort of obvious waiting in the wings. So I think if he runs, he certainly will be the front runner and would probably be the nominee again, and he'd have a rematch. So I imagine most of the facial expressions of the listeners out there are probably something between a grimace and a sigh. Facial expression, but yeah, that I think is probably the most likely scenario right now. But obviously, it's a few years off.
Yeah, you mentioned that there's nobody really who's an obvious Democratic candidate. I mean, do you see anybody out there as you just sort of survey the landscape who could take a run at it?
Well, I mean, Kamala Harris is, you know, she doesn't seem to have sort of asserted herself as like the natural heir apparent. I think, you know, what could happen when you hear people like Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, making noises, J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, making noises. I also think it's possible that depending on how the midterms go, there are people like John Fetterman in Pennsylvania, possibly Tim Ryan in Ohio, who seem to be in position to do pretty well, who could emerge as sort of overnight national figures, sort of, you know, future faces of the party who have won elections in very competitive states who could all of a sudden get quite a bit of attention as national figures and possible presidential candidates. But again, I mean, I think a lot has to happen before then. I mean, namely like the November elections, and they would have to win that. You know, again, that's probably true of some other people too. But so I think that there would be a field that takes shape, but it's unclear what that would look like.
Speaking of the midterms, the conventional wisdom says that the Democrats will take a butt kicking because that's the way it tends to go, whoever's in power. But I'm wondering, Mark, if you think that in light of maybe some of the recent Supreme Court decisions, as well as some of the legislative wins that Biden has had of late, could that make a difference in the outcome of the midterms in your view?
Yeah, it could. I mean, especially the abortion decision, and there have been early indications, certainly in polling and also in the Kansas referendum that I mean, America does not seem ready to want to, you know, outlaw abortion. And there are, you know, any number of more even extreme measures that are sort of going into place in the state. So that could be determinative. I also think what could be determinative is the Republican Party is not exactly offering a coherent sort of governing agenda at all. I mean, they seem to be very preoccupied with sort of, you know, fighting Donald Trump's battles, the sort of internal civil war and sort of casting out the Liz Cheney's of the world. And I don't know. Right now, their overriding objective seems to be revenge. So it's sort of unclear, you know, if that's going to be a winning strategy or at least a viable alternative to people's, you know, I think impatience with Joe Biden and inflation and all the problems that the Democrats have. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of forces that could definitely mitigate the damage for Democrats in November.
Speaking of strategy, you have this incredible quote in the book from a former Republican congressman who outlined a rather dark and probably unreliable strategy for dealing with Trump going forward. I'm sure you know the quote I'm talking about. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, basically the quote, I mean, a congressman, actually he's not in Congress anymore, but he said, look, we don't have a plan for Donald Trump. We don't know how to deal with him. No one wants to deal with him except just sort of waiting for him to die. I mean, this is, again, it's not me talking, it's a Republican congressman talking. Ultimately, you know, obviously, I don't endorse this, but I also think that it sort of goes to the larger passivity that the Republican Party approaches the Donald Trump problem with. And rest assured, they would call Donald Trump a problem. I don't think they think that it's good for the country. They don't think it's good for them. And it's a very scary proposition to be sort of having the sort of prospect of his supporters, you know, turning on you and Trump himself turning on you. So, you know, look, I included that, you know, again, it's a dark quote. It's a dark sentiment, but it's also, it has a lot of truth to it in that no one wants to deal with this problem themselves. No one wants to fight this battle themselves. They're just sort of happy to step aside and let, you know, in this case, some kind of divine intervention solve their problem for them, which unfortunately is not a historically very reliable method.
I want to read you an email from Leslie who says, does the power rush of reelection and lack of concern for legacy bring to mind the need for term limits? Have these people forgotten that they have been voted in and are representing us and are supposed to improve the lives of every American, not just the ones who voted for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a lot of what we're talking about here. I mean, I mean, term limits has had a number of sort of little boomlets over the years. It never seems to take off, largely because of the people who have to vote on it are the people who would be term limited, which creates a sort of a natural conflict of interest, I would say. But ultimately, I think what we're looking at here is, you know, something between just the addiction to power, the need for the parking space and the staff and the prestige and the fancy pin and being able to sort of walk to the front of the TSA line, the trappings of power, and also just inertia, just sort of liking to be in the room but not really knowing anything else in your life. And it's kind of sad, but unfortunately, you know, it's what we're dealing with here is the sort of internal impetus to a lot of the people who are serving us right now, allegedly.
Yeah. Well, we've got about a minute to go here, Mark. So I want to ask you very quickly about your 2013 book, This Town, that I mentioned earlier about Washington, D.C. as an intersection of money and politics and media. Looking back from here, after 4 years of Trump, global pandemic, insurrection, how are you thinking about Washington these days?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, the Washington of this town certainly seems like kind of a mild comedy of manners. You know, we have bigger fish to fry now. And unfortunately, these problems are real. And I think the story of Washington continues to be kind of dark. But ultimately, it's where it's all happening. So I'm going to keep watching it, and hopefully the Republic will survive. But either way, it's been great being with you, Tracy.
Well, you as well, Mark. There's going to be a lot more for you to write about, I think, for better or for worse. And we'll be watching.
It's better or for worse.
We'll be watching for that for sure. Mark Leibovich is our guest. He's the author of Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission. Mark, again, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Tracy.
Our producers today have been Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. Our engineer is Diana Martinez. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. You have been listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.